This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, the weekend edition of Family Research Council's Washington Watch.
Hello and welcome to the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm David Salkel. Tony took the week off this week to spend some time with his family, and one of the people filling in for him on Washington Watch Live was radio talk show host Sandy Rios. Big news this week on the religious liberty front. United States Marine Corps Lance Corporal Manifa Sterling was court-martialed after she refused to take down Bible verses she had posted in her workspace and for reposting the verses after her supervisor threw them in the trash. A trial court ruled against Sterling, giving her a bad conduct discharge and reducing her rank. Senior Counsel and Director of Military Affairs for First Liberty Institute, Mike Berry, joined Sandy with the latest.
Michael, thank you for joining us, and thank you again, even before we start to talk, for the good work that you do on behalf of America's military, who seems to be under assault for their First Amendment, the exercise of their First Amendment rights to free expression of their faith. So thank you for joining us today, first of all.
Well, thanks for having me, Sandy. It's always great to be on Washington Watch.
Yeah, so what, Michael, what happened? What did the court decide? Let's just tell them that first, and then what happened?
Well, the decision was a 4-1 decision, so there was one dissenting opinion, which I think I would point out was a very common sense application of the law to the facts of this case. But nevertheless, the majority opinion held that they didn't think that Sterling, and by extension our legal brief, really did an adequate job of explaining why displaying a Bible verse was an important part of her religious belief. In other words, they said that she didn't even satisfy the sincerely held part of the test that RFRA requires. You know, the federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, says you have to have a sincerely held religious belief that the government has put a substantial burden on. And they said that they didn't think that she did an adequate job of proving just how important this was to her and to her religious belief. That's outrageous.
It is outrageous, because I was listening to the report again, I was thinking, well, why in the world would you put a verse that says, "No weapon formed against thee shall prosper," Isaiah 54:17, if you didn't have a religious motivation? I mean, you just don't do that. No, who does that except for people that verse means something to them for religious reasons?
That's exactly right. You know, the other thing the court did was they kind of used this results-oriented backdoor approach and said, well, she didn't get along really well with her supervisor, and so in that context, they interpreted the placement of that verse as combative, and so therefore, she was really putting it there to be combative, not to be religious. Well, the problem with that is the Supreme Court for decades and other federal courts have said it's not really the role of courts to get into whether or not somebody's religious exercise is based in a religious belief or not. If they tell you it's religious and they appear on their face to be sincere, then that should be good enough for the court. Well, this court decided, no, you know, we're going to substitute our judgment and our interpretation of what something that's important to somebody. And they even went so far as to say, look, if you're a Muslim and you're wearing a hijab, that's important to you. That's a central tenet of the Muslim faith. And so, you know, that's obvious. But here, displaying a Bible verse, no, you're going to have to prove to the government just how important that is.
Michael, they actually said that?
Yeah, they use the example of a Muslim who wears a hijab that is patently religious.
If I weren't mad before, I'm mad now. I'm sorry. I want to say you just got to be kidding me, but I know you're not kidding me. I can't believe that they actually had the audacity to say that a Christian cannot post a Bible verse, but a Muslim can wear a hijab because that's an expression of their faith. That's a bridge too far.
I don't want to mischaracterize the court. I mean, the majority, they didn't just say a Christian can't do it. They said a Christian can do it as long as they can prove through with evidence that is an important precept of their faith.
Well, how are you? So the burden of proof, how in the world do you prove a thing like that? Well, Michael, there's always a story behind the story, and I know you're representing her, so perhaps you can't tell the story behind the story, but what can you tell us on a personal level about what actually happened here? I'm reading, and Shannon reported, that her Sterling superior repeatedly ordered her to remove it. She refused, and then the superior trashed the signs. What can you tell us about that?
You know, that's a great point, Sandy, yes. And so while it certainly is reasonable for the courts to look at some of the context and circumstances around this incident, it's not fair for them to only pick and choose the facts that kind of suit their narrative. And so what's important to know is that Sterling is a young black female Marine of Haitian descent who happens to be a devout Christian. And her supervisor actually happens to be her former drill instructor. So anybody who served in the military will understand that by default there may not be the happiest of relationships between somebody and their former drill instructor. And so nevertheless, she felt that she was being picked on and perhaps bullied. Why, I don't know. I'm not going to speculate that it had to do with her minority status, but nevertheless, she felt that she was being picked on and bullied, and that she put the Bible verse there as a source of comfort and refuge for herself in the midst of what she felt, you know, was her being picked on. And so the court took that and said, well, that must clearly mean she was being antagonistic. You know, which clearly just fails to understand and comprehend the nature of day-to-day military life, that if you're the junior person and a senior person is picking on you, you don't really get the opportunity to be very antagonistic. But you will often seek sources of refuge and comfort, and she turned to the Bible and to this verse from Isaiah. So seven words from the Old Testament somehow were so harmful to the military, according to the majority opinion, that it resulted in her being charged with a military crime, and she now has a federal criminal conviction on her record because the seven words from the Old Testament book of Isaiah, which were a comfort and a refuge for her, somehow were so detrimental to the military that she had to be charged with this crime.
You guys are appealing to the Supreme Court, are you not?
We certainly plan to, the odds, as any attorney who practices before the Supreme Court knows, they're very long odds, but we are hopeful that the Supreme Court will see this and review the opinion and recognize the error, and not just the error, but the harm that will be done to hundreds of thousands of service members across our country. You know, we have 1.3 million people on active duty in our military. And according to the latest DOD survey, approximately 75% identify as religious. So I'm not a math expert, but I know that's at least over 750,000 people who this will directly affect. Because now, you know, RFRA, the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, we've had courts that say this applies to private citizens, it applies to churches, it applies to universities, it even applies to businesses. But if you're in the military, you have this additional burden now where you have to prove that your religious exercise is so sincere and important to you that you're entitled to the protection of RFRA. That's outrageous.
It is outrageous. It's almost unprovable. You know, it's just not provable. And so that's the task that you guys have. And First Liberty, of course, Institute has been defending so many people who've been under attack in the military. You've won some of them, Michael, and this is a loss. It's a big loss. And I would also say that Michael is part, along with the General Boykin has started this organization called Restore Military Religious Freedom Coalition, which American Family Association is part of too, and we've been pushing back and having some measure of success, and certainly with attorneys like Mike Berry on the front lines, we hope to have more success in the future. But it depends on the courts, and we all know that the courts depend on who's going to appoint those judges. It's important information. Mike Berry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Sandy.
You can find out more about First Liberty Institute when you visit tonyperkins.com. When we return, Tom Fitton, president of Judicial Watch, joins us to talk about new information regarding Hillary Clinton's private email server. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more of the weekend edition of Washington Watch.
It's no secret that many members of the media are clueless where it comes to the essential role religion plays in our society. At a time when faith and religious liberty are the subject of much debate, this is a big cause for concern. This lack of understanding raises the question, can politics and current events be written about without the aid of religious context? Can the American media faithfully carry out its duty to tell the whole story if it does not grasp the rich culture of faith that surrounds its content? In an important talk, Michael Cromarty of the Ethics and Public Policy Center uses as his foundation the idea that there is hardly any story in the news today that is not somehow related to religion. Using his unique perspective on the American media's interaction with matters of faith, he also delves into the practical way in which his Faith Angle Forum is helping to bridge the media and religion divide. Visit frc.org/mediaandreligion to view this talk and many more. That's frc.org/mediaandreligion.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Well, thanks to our friends at Judicial Watch, we continue to get updated information regarding what Hillary Clinton fights to keep hidden regarding her use of a private email server while with the State Department. This week, Judicial Watch released 296 pages of emails from the Democratic presidential nominee, including 44 that Judicial Watch says were not previously handed over to the State Department by Clinton. On Thursday, Judicial Watch President Tom Fitton joined guest host Sandy Rios with the latest.
Tom, let's start with first things first. This afternoon, the news broke that there is no investigation. I want to know your thoughts about that.
Well, it's not surprising. I think eventually there's going to have to be an investigation if there isn't one already. This material is too significant to ignore. And there's a lot of smoke here in the lease suggesting potential violations of the law. And the Justice Department can only be so partisan. At least they have to go through the motions of an investigation.
So are you saying you think there still might be an investigation?
Yeah, I don't know if these reports are completely accurate or not. I don't know. I mean, Fox News has reported previously that there was an investigation. So I'm not quite sure if unofficial statements count for much in this type of context.
Okay.
And given the most recent revelations, maybe there's an investigation right now and there wasn't one yesterday.
You know, Rich Edson did a good job, I think, of kind of giving a good overview of what you guys have uncovered. But let's dig down. I know you've been talking about it nonstop, Tom, but every audience is new. And it's let's just start this way. What does it look like is happening? Just an overview without details. What do we think is happening here? What does it seem that is unseemly about what's revealed in these emails?
Well, when Mrs. Clinton came into office, the Secretary of State, she was nominated, people were immediately concerned, both Democrats and Republicans, that there be issues with the Clinton Foundation and Bill Clinton's personal business, and it was causing a mess. And in order to secure the votes of Democrats and Republicans, she committed to an ethics process that kept her out of the Clinton Foundation and the State Department generally out of the Clinton Foundation in terms of her top people there, and that there'd be vetting of any issues that may be a conflict with what Bill was up to. So she signs this agreement to stay out of Clinton Foundation business. And within minutes, not literally, but pretty quickly, you have, in these emails, communications between a top executive at the Clinton Foundation and Yuma Abedin, her deputy chief of staff, who also had worked at the Clinton Foundation, then now at the State Department, about getting a meeting for a billionaire foreign donor of the Clinton Foundation. And there's good reason why people are aghast and the media is covering this the way it is, because that obviously ain't right.
You know, something that I think we maybe would make this more familiar to people, anytime someone runs for public office, if they're a wealthy person, they put their money in trust so that their public decisions, their decisions when they're in office, their influence will not help their business. There won't be any conflict of interest. We've always taken that for granted. And this is like the ultimate influence, to be the Secretary of State or the President, and then to allegedly use your position to help to make money, actually for your family and your foundation. That really is the heart of this. Did they do it or did they not? And so, Tom, Doug Band, Paul Mierenkopf has a real interesting piece on this, and he gives us a little background. He says Doug Band, who runs the Clinton Foundation, was listed as a passenger on the Lolita Express flight with Bill Clinton, with the pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. That's just pretty interesting information. And he's the one that's writing to Huma Abedin asking for some favor for someone in the foundation, correct?
Well, that's correct. And the person he was asking a favor for was Mr. Shaguri, who is a Nigerian-Lebanese official or person who is a billionaire. He had a sketchy past himself, but he was a big million-dollar-plus, at least, donor to the foundation. Pledged $1 billion for some global initiative project. And so I think the language is, and I don't have it in front of me, but he said something to the effect that he wants to talk to the person on Lebanon. And, you know, he's very important to us.
Listen, Tom, I appreciate your time so much. And again, you know how much, you must know how much the American people appreciate your hard work. You are really on the front lines.
To find out more about the work Tom Fitton and Judicial Watch is doing, simply go to TonyPerkins.com and follow the links. Coming up next, a look at the recent execution of a scientist in Iran. We'll be back with more Washington Watch right after this.
Are you prepared to stand for real change? Mark your calendar for the Values Voter Summit on September 9th through 11th in Washington, D.C. Join thousands of like-minded Americans who envision a culture in which human life is valued, families flourish, and religious liberty thrives. Past speakers at the Values Voter Summit have included Senators Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Governor Mike Huckabee, Laura Ingraham, Kirk Cameron, Dr. Ben Carson, Glenn Beck, Sean Hannity, Ollie North, Mark Levin, and many others. In addition, there will be ample opportunity to network and meet with organizations and attendees that share a Christian worldview and to discuss important issues like religious liberty, the sanctity of life, natural marriage, national security, government overreach, and more. On September 9th through 11th, stand with us and fight for the renewal of this great nation. Visit valuesvotersummit.org for more information and to watch last year's event. That's valuesvotersummit.org.
Welcome back to the weekend edition of Washington Watch. I'm David Salkeld. Revelations surrounding the execution of an Iranian nuclear scientist continue to come out. After being accused of spying for the United States by Iran, Shahram Amiri was accused of treason and later executed. On Thursday, Iranian expert and freedom scholar at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Michael Ledeen, joined guest host Sandy Rios with his analysis.
Thank you, Michael, for making time for us today.
Hi, Sandy. How are you? Nice to be with you.
I'm good. Michael, what you wrote about the death of Shahram Amiri just stunned me this week, and so I would love, as dreadful as it is, for you to tell us what you think happened. First of all, what do we know about him for sure? Anything?
We know that he disappeared from Saudi Arabia in 2009, where he had gone on Hajj, a religious pilgrimage. And the next we hear from him is 2010, when he walks into the Iranian intersection at the Pakistani embassy and asks to go back to Iran. And when that happens, we agreed to send him back. And then the government briefs a whole series of journalists. This is the really odd part to me, anyway. Government briefs a whole series of journalists from Associated Press, New York Times, Washington Post, you name it. And they say, here's this guy, Amiri. He spied for the CIA in Iran for years, providing us with information about the Iranian nuclear program. And now he's going back. We don't know why he wants to go back, but he does want to go back. And he was here freely, and he's leaving freely. And that's it. Well, now, when I read that, I said, good grief, here's the American government trying to get this man killed. Because if you send him back to Iran with the official-looking story saying he was a spy for CIA, they're going to kill him. And they did kill him. They pretended that it was a heroic event. They threw a big party for him when he got back and so on. Then arrested him, tried him. Sentenced him to some number of 10 or 12 years for espionage, and a few weeks ago hung him. So that's what we know, and it's a horrible story.
It is a horrible story. And Michael, you know, the thing that, you know, as a layperson, the thing that really caught my eye in the story, well, started to catch my eye in the story, is his claim, of course, that he was kidnapped and brought here. And then how Mrs. Clinton, she comes out publicly, says, oh, he's here of his own free will and he can go back when he wants. Well, that seemed odd to me, too. Like, Why would she signal that publicly? And it sounds as though if he were trying to help us, they're giving him absolutely no cover whatsoever.
Right. This kind of thing happens. You know, spy stories aren't like regular stories. And all kinds of weird things happen. I'm familiar with a big spy story of a defector from Romania in 1978, the head of their intelligence service. And he came over with everything. He's arguably the most important defector we ever had. But he kept on saying that we had been deceived by Ceausescu and the Romanian government into believing that Romania was somehow independent of Moscow and that we could deal with Romania as an independent country. And he said, that's a deception. And believe me, I know it's a deception because I did it. That was one of my jobs. And CIA, which had told American presidents that they could deal with Ceausescu, that Romania was independent, that we could sell technology to Romania and it wouldn't go to Moscow, they were furious. And they threatened to send him back to certain death. And there was a huge fight inside the intelligence community, and finally he won. But this kind of thing happens. It happens. Now, I can imagine that Amiri defected to the United States. That seems clear. He was under a protection program in this country. He had a salary from CIA, some millions of dollars. And I can imagine that he, who worked on Iranian nuclear programs, might well have said, look, this whole story that you guys put out about Iran suspending or ending its nuclear weapons program in 2003. That's nonsense. That was a deception. And believe me, I know because I worked on it. I was there in the secret headquarters and so on. And they would be furious. And they might well threaten to send him back. And then the Iranians might somehow have found him in the United States, which would be yet another intelligence failure on our part. And they may have said to him, look, if you come back, everything will be fine. We'll take good care of you, and we won't kill your 7-year-old son. And that works. So who knows? There's a lot we don't know.
So I think this is always a point of confusion. It surely does seem, I'm putting it mildly, that this administration, the Obama administration, has a tremendous affinity for Iran. Thus, the $400 billion payment in an unmarked plane, you know, in cash last week, and this deal that is so one-sided that is really actually allowing them to develop nuclear weapons, and on we could go. And this, if your theory about this scientist is true, you know, wanting him to be, we don't know. You know, how do we know? But let's say it all does fit. It certainly does all comport to the benefit of Iran. What then is, how would you compare Iran and its philosophy, its religious beliefs, and the Islamic State? One's Sunni and one's Shia. Is that the only distinction?
Well, they're in cahoots. Iran participated in the creation of ISIS. And supported them at the time. ISIS grew out of al-Qaeda in Iraq. And al-Qaeda in Iraq was run by Zarqawi. Zarqawi operated for many years from Tehran. He lived in Iran. He was supported by Iran. And that was home base for him. So it's a straight line, as far as ISIS is concerned, from Iran's constant support of terrorism. It's no accident that every year the State Department announces to no one's surprise that Iran is the world's greatest sponsor of terrorism. And this is a straight line from Tehran to the leading terrorist groups. They're up to their necks in it, all over the place.
All right, so we're in a presidential cycle, and we can draw some pretty stark lines between President Obama and his policies. Who knows his motivations? We could speculate. We know that Valerie Jarrett was born in Iran. We know a lot of things. But how about Hillary Clinton in terms of, you know, if she should be elected and take the baton from President Obama, how would her policy toward Iran be different?
And then somebody ask her. I guess because she never has a press conference. She hasn't had a press conference in, what, half a year? Incredible.
Yeah, but it's true. But we also know that she's very involved in, certainly, in people that are friendly to the Muslim Brotherhood. There's no question about that. I just wasn't sure about her connection with Iran. If she has, I really honestly don't know. It certainly, she was a Secretary of State while all this was unfolding, and she didn't seem to complain too much about what was happening.
She was Secretary of State for a president who has wanted a strategic alliance with Iran and has worked to that end ever since the presidential campaign of 2008. Been going on since before he was sworn in. He sent a back channel to Tehran during the election campaign, and this guy told the Iranians, Obama's going to win, and everything's going to be wonderful because he wants to really sit down and work with you. The Iranians have never believed it, and they don't want to work with him. So it has failed. But in the meantime, he constantly hoping that this will happen, does anything and everything Iran wants, from sending them cash to making these outrageous swaps for prisoners and hostages, to backing off his red line with Syria, to talking about cooperating with Iran's close ally Russia in Syria and Iraq. On and on it goes.
Yeah, on and on it goes.
To find out more about Michael Ledeen, head over to TonyPerkins.com. Also, while you're there, sign up for Tony's Washington Update. It's a daily email highlighting the important issues affecting your faith, family, and freedom. Well, that's it for this week's show. I'm David Salkeld, thanking you for being with us, and I encourage you to be back here next week for the weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins.
The weekend edition of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you've heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can help support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 866-372-7234.